Blog Talk Radio.
This is ATL Designer, the host of In the Mood, and you are listening to Unmasked with authoress Terry E. Lyle, right here on Blog Talk Radio. You know, Terry brings you all the hot topics for your listening pleasure. Each and every Friday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Just go to www.blogtalkradio.com. That's www.blogtalkradio.com. And you can also reach Terry direct. Her number is 347-945-6003. That's 347-945-6003. So log in, listen, enjoy. I'll see you there.
And now, the art of love.
My lady wears the best, or she wears nothing at all. And that's why authoress Terry E. Lyle has designed her own personal fragrance collection. She has 10 to choose from. They are Unmasked, Insane, Confessions, Peeling Back the Mask, Forgiveness, Say It Ain't So, Speechless, Exposed, In the Bag, and Wow. They all have a fruity and hint of light flower smell. Some descriptions could be a soft, tantalizing, fresh aroma, tropical and exotic sweet smell of light flowers and melon scent. The smell of romance is in the air. A 3.4-ounce bottle of perfume is $60. An 8-ounce bottle of lotion is $20. They all smell so good to me. But you don't have to take my word for it. Go to her personal website at www.terrylyle.com. That's www.terrylyle.com. Or you can reach her direct. The number, 443-956-8753. That's 443-956-8753. And make sure that you specify which bottle of perfume or lotion you wish to purchase. Terry accepts PayPal and all other major credit cards. All products have a money-back guarantee on all fully unused containers. Make your choice today. And oh, don't forget, when the mood is right and you're relaxed, then listen to Unmasked with Terry E. Lyle every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio. Well, if you excuse me, I like to get back to making it do what it do, baby. Peace.
Baby, my time is too expensive, and I'm not a little boy. If you are serious, don't play with my heart. It makes me furious. But if you want me to love you, sinner, baby, I wish. Girl, you know I wish. Tell it like it is. Don't be ashamed. Let your conscience be your guide. But I know deep down inside of me, I believe you love me. Forget your foolish pride. Life is too short to have sorrow. You may be here today and gone tomorrow. You might as well get what you want. So go on and live. Baby, go on and live. Tell it like it is. I'm nothing to play with. Go and find yourself some. But I tell it like it is. My time is too expensive, and I'm not your little boy.
Well, well, well. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Unmasked with authoress Terry E. Lyle and Shalonda. And today my special guest is a lady by the name of Gail Delicious Johnson from Capitol Heights, Maryland. And she's going to share with us what happened. You know, how did she get it together after she was raped? She's an author, she's a publisher, she's an actress and a radio host. And it's with great pleasure I want to welcome Gail Delicious Johnson. How are you, darling?
Hi, I'm fine. Hi, Shalondra. How you doing, darling?
How you doing, Ms. Gail? How are you today?
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Well, I just want to ask you, Gail, how long has it been since you was raped? Because to women, oh, my God, that's the worst thing that could happen to someone, to take control and abuse you, and sometimes it's worse for others. Some people are physically battered along with the rape, and I can't even begin to act like I understand what that's like, and I pray to God that never happens to me. But what were your age when this occurred, and what was the catalyst around this event?
Well, when it happened, I was 15 years old. I'll be 65 this year, so you can do the math. Mm-hmm. What had happened was I had a curfew. I had to be in at 10 o'clock at night. And me and a couple of my girlfriends was walking home from the old neighborhood I used to live in. One of the girls lived in the neighborhood that I moved to. And a couple of guys was, you know, behind us. A few of the guys I knew, but the rapist I did not know. And, you know, we're just walking, and we stopped at in front of my girlfriend's house for, you know, for a few minutes, because I had at least 15 minutes before I had to be home. And from where I was at, it wouldn't take me no more than 5 minutes to get home. So we're standing there talking, and this guy comes up to me, and he says he wanted to talk to me. So, you know, 15, I really wasn't wanting to talk to him because, number one, he wasn't an attractive guy, not to say that, you know, I was, you know, I mean, he just wasn't, he was a creepy-looking guy to me. He looked really creepy. You know, and he was really black as night, not to say that I had anything against black guys or anything like that, but it was just his whole appearance was not, I didn't really want to have anything to say to him, period. So then, you know, I'm still standing there, and he said he wanted to talk to me, so I said, well, you know, talk. So he said around, you know, he wanted to take me away from the crowd that I was with, so I said, well, we can talk right here. So then he proceeded to put his hand around my neck the back way and applied pressure. And, you know, he said, well, we're going to go around here. So I'm walking around there, you know. Not the rape was the last thing that crossed my mind that he was going to do. So we get around there, and it was a tree. he pushed me up against a tree, and so he started talking all this crazy stuff. Then he said, drop your drawers. And I said, what? You know, so he said it again, and I said, no. So then that's when he hit me. And when he hit me in my mouth, as soon as I, you know, after he hit me, I grabbed my mouth, and my mouth was so swollen, and it was bleeding, so I started crying. And someone had opened their window and was looking out, you know. So he turns around and tells them, shut that MFing window and mind your business. And they shut the window. And that was it. So from that point, he moved me from that particular area because I guess, you know, by that person looking out the window, he obviously was feeling uncomfortable or whatever. So he moved me from that particular area to another area, and he said the same thing, drop your pants. So I'm crying. You know, I'm still saying no. He said, I will beat you to death if you don't drop your pants. So I'm, you know, pulling my pants down as slowly as I could, and he pulled them down, you know, pushed me on the ground, and proceeded to rape me. So when we was finished, he says to me, was I going to tell anybody? And, of course, I said no, because I wanted to come out there alive. You know, if I had said, well, yeah, I'm going to tell, you know. So I said, I said, no, I'm not going to tell anybody. So we're walking down to where the area where he abducted me from. And, you know, of course, most of the people was gone. My girlfriend, she was gone in the house. And the other girl who came from the other project, I think she was gone. But it was, you know, a couple of other guys that were still out there. And so he had walked me to my girlfriend's door. And when her mom opened the door, I screamed. I said, he raped me. And he ran. So one of the guys in the group.
Real quick, Gail, you said that he had, when he raped you, did he also sodomize you?
No. No, he didn't sodomize
me. That's a lesson right there. And you said that he busted your mouth and your lips were swollen. When he was escorting you back to where he had abducted you, did any of the guys that were still there notice your mouth was swollen, notice your demeanor was a little frightened? Did anybody notice just by physically looking at you?
No, not until after, well, when I had screamed that he had raped me and he ran, one of the guys that I knew who came over and he saw what was going on, he saw my face and he said, what happened? And I told him what had happened and I asked him, he said, I don't know if I had asked him, but anyway, he somehow or another, I got the rapist's name. He gave me the guy's name. And the police, the girl's mother called the police. The police came. And at this particular time back then, we had like a precinct, not a precinct, but it was called Women's Bureau, where police women dealt with females. And, you know, the males dealt with males. And police women came out, and they took me home, and they got my mom, and they took me to the hospital, and they did, you know, checking to see what had happened and this and that. So in the meantime, my brother had, because they had gotten his address and everything, these guys was giving up this information on this guy who had raped me. They
right.
went, my brother and a friend had went around to his house, but I don't guess they got an answer or whatever. But to make a long story short, he was eventually brought to trial for what he did to me. And one of the girls who was there, she even saw where he had his hand around my neck. But when she said it, she said she thought that I was going willingly because she couldn't see the fact that he was squeezing my neck.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So she testified, and at that particular time, all they had was the Youth Act. You know, they had begun the Youth Act, meaning that if you was like a juvenile, you go to jail, you could get out when you possibly was turned 21. So he was 17, and he got locked up for statutory rape and batter. So he got out when he got the Youth Act. I do know that. But going to trial, it was almost as if I was being raped over again because they, you know, ask you questions and then they try to make you feel like it's your fault, you know, that you brought this on yourself because they would ask me, what did you have on? What time was it? Did you know him? And did he ejaculate in you? And, you know, all those questions. And I'm just saying, you know, I just felt so humiliated. I felt embarrassed. I felt hurt. I just felt, you know, like I didn't really want to exist anymore.
Right.
But, you know, after the rape, everything quieted down. My family and I, we never spoke about it. Nothing was ever said about it again. I never discussed it with any of my friends. You know, even though they knew, they never, you know, questioned me or said anything to me about it. And, you know, I suppressed it, you know, for years. And we had a reunion. Now, this was, like I said, I got raped when I was 15. And I think I was, like, maybe 45, 46, 47, in that range, when I saw him again. And when I did see him, I didn't know it was him because, you know, all those years, I really wasn't trying to look at his face or remember anything about him. And so when I saw him, we was at a reunion, and the girl who had testified on my behalf was talking to him. And so I had taken her home after the reunion. I asked her, I said, who was that you was talking to? So when she told me, I said, it just felt like everything I could see, everything from that point, all those years prior to that, you know, came rushing back. And then I said, well, what was y'all talking about? She's telling me that they were talking about her son, blah, 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 but she never knew him. She never knew him because, you know, back then, she didn't know him, and I didn't know him, and the other girl I was with, I think she may have known him through her boyfriend who was in the crowd, but the girl that I'm speaking of who testified against him, she did not know him. So anyway, they were talking, and to make a long story short, they eventually developed a relationship.
Okay, stop right there. I don't want to get into the lady and the rapist getting into a relationship yet. We're going to get to that story, but I want to stop you right there, and I want to ask a question about after they got him, his name and everything, he was prosecuted, correct?
Yes.
And how long did he do time? Whether it was in juvenile detention or whatever, how long was he in there? Because you said 17, so he only had a year left. I mean, 3 years left, 4 years left.
Well, I think he got out when he was 21 because that's when they were, you know, considering them being rehabilitated and whatever, you know. But I think that's what had happened. He got out when he was 21, 22, something like that. But he did not do the time that that a rapist would do today, you know. So,
right. Did it come out somewhere along the line that the reason why he raped you because maybe he had a secret desire for you all along and he probably didn't feel like he would get a chance by approaching you? I mean, why do you think that you was the one picked since you were with a group of females at the time when he escorted you away from the group?
You know what? That is the $100 million question. I've asked myself that over and over. And even though I've seen him on occasions after I turned, got in my 40s, mm-hmm. I've always wanted to ask him, you know, why me? You know, so I really don't know why I was singled out. I don't know. But that's a good question, and I really wish that I could have that question answered. But I don't
right.
know.
Because if you think about it, the rape is egregious at the best. But, you know, he took you there. He busted you in the mouth because you refused to take your pants down. Okay, but when we talk about rape today, it could have been so much worse because I'm not understanding why he was so stupid enough to bring you back to the point of where he escorted you away, why he was stupid enough to not just get rid of you because you don't want no witnesses. So I'm thinking there was something else going on, you know, other than, you know, it was just a random rape opposed to somebody watching you and trying to see an available opportunity to grab you because you would think most time people say, you know, get rid of all the evidence. So if you don't have any witnesses, you know, you can't do any time. But he brung you back, you know.
Well, let me say this. That night was the first time I had ever seen him in my life. that was the first night I've ever seen him. And then I think because of his age and then the fact that I told him that I wasn't going to tell anybody, what was made him feel comfortable enough to walk me back. You know, because if I say I'm not going to tell anybody, you know, I guess he felt, well, I guess it did to him, because he walked me back down to where he had taken me from. But like I said, that was the first time I'd ever seen him in my life.
Wow. Well, I see my co-host, Shalonda. She got a question. I'm going to go ahead and ask her a question. Go ahead, Shalonda, darling.
Thank you. So, Gail, after you went through the rape and went to court and everything, did you have any type of, say, therapist or anything to help you get through it and understand what happened since you were a child? Did anybody offer you any assistance?
No, because I'm going to tell you, back during that time, you know, living in the projects, I grew up in the projects, in a dysfunctional family, and it was more or less a thing where it was never spoken of. You know, it was done, and that was it. You know, and I really didn't want to think about it. I didn't want to have people to, you know, look at me and say, she got raped and this and that. So it was a thing where I just went on and, you know, got on with my life and, you know, did what I had to do. And then, like I said, years later when I did see him again, it was like everything. I just had a flashback to that particular time. And then when the girl had gotten to a relationship with him, that really was what the straw that had broke the camel's back. So, no, I did not get therapy. And I think basically I went through some type of changes because I became a drug addict. I had shut down. I didn't want to be, you know, bothered with being in relationships and things. But then at one point when I did start to get into being with, I wouldn't say being with having relationships, but just I had become very promiscuous to the point where I didn't, my feelings were like
cold, indifferent.
Yeah, my feelings were different, and I really didn't feel that, you know, I just lost a little bit of my self-worth as far as, like, you know, wanting to be in relationships and things like that, because I just felt like it wasn't worth it, you know, after what had happened.
Right. Well, everybody who's listening right now, you can call in at 347-945-6003. If you hit the number one key, it lets me know that you have a question. If you don't hit anything, you can just listen in until you want to make a comment, if that's your choice. But we want to take a small break, and we're going to come back with Gail Delicious Johnson as she shares the story of being raped and how she made it through. This might help some of you people out there who have daughters or who have been a victim of rape. But stay with us, and we'll be back in 2 and 2.
An old friend that I want to say something that touched my heart, and it began this way. I was born just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come. I
Eventually, the truth will come out of the darkness for everyone to see.
Hello?
Hey, this is Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
How you doing?
Oh yeah, everything's good. Everything's good. Just been really busy. Sorry I haven't been here this week.
Yes.
Oh, I forgot, but I will be there next week.
Right now.
There are times in your life when your faith will be challenged.
Hey man, I want to share something with you. I accepted Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior. He's been really wonderful to me. Don't you agree?
I feel like I'm my own God. The things that's been happening to me, I feel like I've been making those things happen.
Wait a minute. You mean to tell me you don't believe in God?
Well, I haven't seen it.
The truth can come in shocking form.
Who is this, man? Oh, hell no. I know ain't nobody up in my house when I'm at work all day, going day.
Terry E. Lyle. Check out her website and on Blog Talk Radio every Friday at 7:30 p.m.
Wow, welcome back to Unmasked with authoress Terry E. Lyle and Shalonda. And I want to thank all my listeners for tuning in tonight because you could have been anywhere, but you decided to hang out with us, and I so appreciate that. And I just want to say hi to Lucky, a friend of mine. I see that she's in the hospital with pneumonia, so we're sending out prayers and a request that you get better real soon, Lucky, because it ain't no fun, and I know you're worried about your kids. So special shout-out this evening go to Lucky, my friend in Baltimore, Maryland, and I hope you're feeling better soon and catch you next week. But our guest tonight is Gail Delicious Johnson out of Capitol Heights, Maryland, And she's sharing her story, how she was raped and how it went through the stages, I'm sure, of anger, low self-esteem, of fear, you know, until she got back on track, you know, and now she's an actress, publisher, a radio host herself, a writer. So she has come a long way, but we want to welcome her back and thank her for spending the time tonight to share such a horrific story. Welcome back, Gail. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. You left out the fact that I'm also a ghostwriter, Dolly, and a speaker.
Yes. Well, a writer is a writer. Whether someone pay you more to be a ghostwriter is neither here or there. But if you're a writer, you're a writer. And for people who don't understand what a ghostwriter is, that is someone who will write your story for you, but you pay them a large amount of money up front because you're saying that they have no rights to your royalties, they have no rights to have their name on your product or nothing like that. So they're getting paid up front for what's projected might come out of their work. So she is a ghostwriter, and my mistake, Mrs. Johnson, for not saying.
Oh, no mistake, darling. You didn't make a mistake. You just left it out.
Well, I want to get right back quickly, and I want to talk about the guy who raped you. Did you ever find out whether or not he came from a dysfunctional family? Why? Because, you know, people are not born rapists. I mean, did you find out a little bit more about him while you was going through the trial, whether he was abused as a kid, whether he saw craziness going on in his house? I mean, who just grew up to be a rapist? It just doesn't happen like that.
Well, you know what, I know that he wasn't born a rapist, but I didn't really find out that much at the trial about his childhood, and as a matter of fact, I really don't remember that much that they discussed about his childhood or anything like that, because the things you see on television is basically not how it really happens in a court, but he did lie and say that he was at home during the time that it happened. And so they asked him, well, what was you doing? You know, was anybody there? He said he was watching television. They asked him, what was he watching on television? He said he don't remember, but he was dozing off. They said, well, do you remember anything that you was watching on television, what channel you was watching? So he said the last thing he do remember seeing was a beer commercial on whatever channel, because back then we didn't have that many channels. You know, there was no cable or anything. But so what they did was called the television station and found out that there was not a commercial on at that particular time, that he was not home. So then I guess they did some other investigation, and then the fact that the girl who saw him with his hands around my neck had gave up her information. But, you know, as far as, like, finding out him coming from a dysfunctional family, I'm quite sure there was some type of dysfunction going on in there, because over the years, I learned from the girl who was in a relationship with him how he had told her that he had broke a chair over his sister's back. He had beat his baby's mama so much until she moved out of town. And when we get to the fact that when they got into a relationship, I will explain to just what had happened to her. You know, but it had to be something going on with him in his life. But if he was... whatever happened to him, you don't have to inflict that on other people, because when I was raped, that was the last thing I wanted to happen to anybody, and no way in the world I would try to go out and do harm to somebody because someone had harmed me, because I know how it feels. You know, so all these people saying, well, maybe this happened to him, you know, that's true. You know, you do, if you go through some things when you're a child, you may grow up and be a rapist if you've been molested. You may grow up to be an abuser if someone's constantly beating on you. But those are decisions that you make along the way. Because, you know, like you said, no one is born to be a rapist. No one is born to be an abuser and all these things. Those are conscious decisions that you make, because if you're constantly seeing somebody beat on your mother, you're going to grow up and you're going to start beating on women. No, what you have to do is say, I would never beat my woman like the way my father beat my mother. You know, you would have to be a strong person. You know, because I felt that even though I was going through the trauma that I was going through, basically I was really abusive to myself, because, like I said, I became a drug addict. And you know, just different things that I was doing to compensate for that pain and that hurt and that suffering, that anguish and all those different things I was going through. The drugs was like a medication to me. But not knowing that it was also harming me, but while I was high, I didn't have to think about it. You know, it was never crossing my mind. And basically it was something I had just wiped completely out of my mind because I did not want to think about it.
Okay, well, you said that you were 15 when this occurred. So at that particular time, were you sexually active before the rape?
Yes, I was.
Okay. And how soon after this incident did you turn to drugs? Immediately or
no,
a year
no.
later? Or
no. What had happened was because, well, like, I'm more or less a person who's very observant. I watch things and I listen to things. And I didn't really get into the drugs until I was maybe about 21, 22. And how that came about, yeah, it was years and years later. Mm-hmm. But how that came about was I got a job working in a nightclub as a waitress, and this club used to have bands that came through there. And they would have after parties after the club closed out. They would have after parties in, you know, hotels. And, you know, some me and some of the girls would go to these after parties. And, you know, they would be smoking reefer, you know, but and they passed it to me. I kept passing it, you know, because I really, even though some of my friends were smoking and getting high, you know, back when I was maybe about 15, 16 years old, I still couldn't, you know, get into it because it was just something that I didn't want to do.
Right.
So anyway, we went one time. We went to they had an after party, so I went to that one, and they was passing the reefer around. So a girl who was staying with me at this particular time, she said, "Hey, Gail, go in and hit it. Girl, they ain't gonna hurt you. They ain't gonna kill you. Just take one hit." So I said, "Oh Lord!" So I took a hit, and you know, because I was wondering why everybody was, because I would, you know, with some friends at one time when they were smoking it, and all of a sudden they get to laughing and eating everything, and I said, I can't believe that stuff make you act like that. I just can't believe it. You know, so when I took that hit, you know, I felt complete euphoria because I've never had drugs in my body, you know, anything like that. So, you know, so that would have started me to, my escapade with drugs. It started off with marijuana. Then it went from marijuana to acid, mescaline, then from there to heroin, from heroin to crack cocaine. I've done basically every drug except for ecstasy and meth, you know, so that's what
well, they
that
do
was all
say
about.
That marijuana is a gateway drug. And so are you
well,
saying
let me say
that,
this before you, I don't mean to cut you off, but as far as like saying it's a gateway drug, it's still a thing of your decisions that you make. Because there are people that I know that smoke marijuana and has been smoking it forever. You know, they're not even thinking about doing any other drugs because that is their drug of choice. But it depends on the type of environment you're in and how you accept things and what you want to do. You have to make that decision. So I don't really think, me personally, I don't think it was a gateway for me to get on all those drugs. It was more or less the environments that I was in and the people that I was running with that had me, you know, doing those drugs. Because, it was different people. The marijuana was different people who I started, you know, doing the marijuana with. And, you know, different people do different drugs. So, you know, it to me, I don't think that's really the gateway to drugs. But even
okay,
though some people say it is,
I understand. And so, I guess going through all that situation, trying to mentally recover from the rape, you know, it seems like you became somewhat of a follower because, like you just stated, you know, the friends and association that you had was the reason why you was doing crack cocaine, acid, heroin, and everything, and that's some serious shit, you know. So I'm wondering to myself, was it your need to feel like you wanted some acceptance because inside you was hurting because you had the secret of being victimized because of the rape. So do you think that you was doing this stuff, what your friends was doing, because you wanted to be accepted and you wanted to feel like you had a group that was going to protect you indirectly in case something like that was to come back down the pike?
No, what I felt was the enjoyment of the drugs, what the drugs did for me. I could have done the drugs by myself, which I did. A lot of occasions I've gotten high by myself. It wasn't about the acceptance of someone accepting me or wanting me. It was what I was getting from doing the drugs that I wanted.
Well, I applaud you, Ms. Johnson, for being drug-free, because if
people look at
some of the people in rehab, you know, some people, just a year makes a difference in their appearance and their rationalizing things. So I really applaud you, because I wouldn't say I know anything about heroin, because I don't, but I've heard that that's a very difficult drug, so it's crack, to get free of without going through some kind of
withdrawal,
counseling or whatever.
Right. But here's the thing with the difference between crack and heroin. Heroin is the drug that will take you down. It's more or less a downer. Crack cocaine is an upper. And where you can, before you get to, let's say you have a 10-mile walk to go, crack cocaine will take you there quicker than the heroin. And the thing with heroin, you have withdrawals that could kill you if you don't, if you're not under doctor's care and, you know, being watched. With crack cocaine, the only withdrawals that I had or you have with crack cocaine is that you dream about it. You have these urges for it. But it's not like heroin, where heroin can actually kill you if you try to come off. You try to stop, especially if you're heroin who's been an addict for years and years and years, then you wake up one morning and say, I don't want to do heroin anymore. You have a chance of actually dying because your body is so used to those drugs being in it until it goes into, it can go into a coma, seizures, or whatever. It could take your life. When I got off of the crack cocaine.
How did you start withdrawing? Yeah. How did you start your withdrawal from heroin? You know, what did you do that was different?
You know, the strangest thing about that was, and I don't know if, you know, maybe it was because God had other plans for me, but I wasn't really on heroin as long as I was on the crack cocaine. And what happened was, I wasn't like a heroin. I didn't use heroin, like I said, as much as I use crack cocaine. It wasn't an everyday situation. Maybe on the weekends I would get high from like maybe Friday to Saturday to Sunday. There's some weeks I wouldn't get high off of heroin. So it wasn't a thing where it had built up into my system that it would take me to the point of if I stopped, I would convulse or have seizures or, you know, go through those withdrawal systems, which I didn't. And I thank God for that, because I've seen, you know, friends of mine OD. And as a matter of fact, I had OD'd at one point off of heroin, and I was DOA. So, you know, but, you know, you put yourself in these situations, right? You put yourself in these situations, and these are the outcomes. You're not thinking about it as long as it's happening, because that's what you're looking for. And the crazy thing about heroin, when I was using it, if we, like, we would go to, like, oil joints, you call them oil joints because I used to shoot up. We go to these oil joints, and if somebody had OD'd, they say, well, what did they have? What did they have? They had murder one. You know what? We're breaking our necks to get some murder one, because that was the bomb drug. But in your mind, you're not thinking that you could be the next one to OD and not come back. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, it was a crazy cycle, but like I said, it wasn't something that I did. I made habitual as far as, like, using heroin. But the crack cocaine was like Richard Pryor said, that pipe was talking to me. it was telling me, you know, when I put it in a drawer, you know, come on, get some more, get some more. And it really will talk to you.
I know
the ramifications, and also know the outcome of those drugs.
You didn't care. You wanted what you wanted.
Right, right, just what I wanted. Like I said, at times I would get high by myself, because when you're doing cocaine, now here's the difference in when you're doing cocaine, because when you're doing heroin, you get high and you're just nodding out. You're really mellow, you're just nodding out, quiet, this and that. But when you're doing crack, you're like so wired up, you know, and the least thing can get on your nerve. If somebody's asking you, man, I haven't passed that pipe, or put some more in there, that would irritate you to no end. So you know what? I felt much better getting high by myself, because I could really enjoy it. It doesn't really last that long. So if you got somebody saying, hurry and pass the pipe, put some more in it, do this, do that, next thing you know, your high is gone and you're wanting more and more and more. And that's another thing about crack cocaine. Your brain is craving it. You know, it's
well,
just
right
craving it.
Well, my co-host is craving a question she want to ask.
Okay.
So can we put it on pause so she can ask you a question?
So when you started using drugs, you said you were around 20 or so?
Yeah, about 21 when I started.
And how long did it last before you went into recovery?
I went into recovery. What had happened was I had begun to sell cocaine, powder cocaine, and occasionally I would sell crack cocaine. And I got set up and got arrested. Before I went to prison, though, my lawyer had told me that if I, you know, clean my act up and, you know, don't get high anymore when I go to court, blah, 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 this and that. So naturally, I still was doing what I wanted to do, was, you know, getting high. And so I went to court. Well, what had happened was I had wrote the judge a letter confessing, you know, and that just shows you how crazy I was, because I didn't know anything about how the laws worked, you know, what was going on. All I knew was that when I got caught, I did not want to go to jail, because my children, they were young. You see what I'm saying? I didn't want to be away from them. But needless to say, I got locked up. And also, back then, back in the 80s, for what I had, if I'd had that today and got locked up, I would be in jail forever. They tried to give me 20 years, and one of the public defenders had told me that, and these are his exact words, he said, because they found a gun and a box of ammunition in my apartment as well, he says, Ms. Johnson, he said, I'm not trying to brag or anything, he said, and I know I'm a good lawyer, he said, but I don't see how I can get you off. With the gun charge, you're going to get at least 5 years for that. And
wow.
I looked at him, and I said, what? You know, and 5 plus 20, so I said, what? And this was a public defender, you know, meaning that he wasn't getting paid.
That's
100
years.
So what happened, I got a high-price lawyer. I mean, a high-ranking lawyer. He was a lawyer who handled cases like this, because he did a case here in D.C. for one of the most notorious heroin dealers back in the 70s, and I don't want to really get into that. But anyway, he took the case, and I'm going to tell you the thing about lawyers, and if there are any lawyers listening, I'm really not calling you out or anything like that, but lawyers, what they do is, from my experience and what I've learned, you know, dealing with the judicial system since I've, you know, had to deal with them, is that lawyers, you have to tell your lawyer the truth. If you kill somebody, you have to tell him, even though he is going to strategize and have us to say, well, my client is innocent. She wasn't there, this, that. So I told him, he knew the truth. He knew about the gun. He knew about the ammunition. He knew about the 100 grams. He knew about the $30,000 that was found after this and that. But I also had this bodyguard, right, that I didn't find out till later that he was addicted to cocaine, he used to shoot it. And mm-hmm. I didn't find that out until he was in my apartment one night, called himself protecting me, and started shooting up the place. So the police had to come, they took him away. But then he actually OD'd before the trial got underway. And I told the lawyer that. So what the lawyer told the judge was that I was pressured into selling these drugs, that the guy was mm-hmm. my boyfriend, and he had forced me to sell drugs. He had forced me to use them, you know, trying to get me not to go to jail. Now, this judge, he was very, very nice judge. And when I say he was very nice, he gave me, first he said 3 years. He said suspended for 3 years and 6 months in Alderson. He gave me Alderson or Lexington. But when I went to Alderson, I only stayed there for a couple of weeks, and I was transferred to Morgantown, West Virginia, where I stayed there almost for the duration of my time until they had riots in the other prisons. Morgantown was a co-ed prison, and they had riots in the other prisons, so they had to move the women out of that prison to Lexington, Kentucky. And I finished up my time in Lexington, Kentucky. When I got out, now this is just how crazy it was, you know, going through the 12 steps, just that it says stay away from the people, place, and things that influence you, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
I got out still thinking I can go around the same people, you know. And, you know, I'm on probation.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I was on probation. To make a long story short, I got caught up, wasn't going to see my probation officer, and I got caught up. So we gone back to court again. My probation mm-hmm. officer's arguing, well, she needs to be blah, 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 this and that. And I was working, too, because I became a functioning drug addict or whatever. And, you know, he said, you're going to have to tell her job, this and that. I said, well, if you tell my job, I'm just going to quit, you know, because I don't think it's their business, because I don't go to work high. I go to work, do my work, whatever. So, and this judge, this was a mean judge. This was a black judge. The first judge, he was white, not to say I'm not trying to be racist or anything, but this judge, because just before I went before him, this other guy had went before him who had revoked his probation. Mm-hmm. He had gotten out. He hadn't gotten a job. So the judge said to him, he said, well, where do you want to work, in the White House? So the guy, I couldn't hear what he was mumbling, but he said, he called the marshals up. He said, well, you know what? You're going to do your backup time, and maybe when you get out this time, you'll get a job. So I mm-hmm. said, oh, my God. Oh, Lord, that man going to send me back to jail. So, you know, during the trial, the PO, he's arguing, well, this, that. The lawyer, he's arguing this and that. And, you know, something just came over me in that courtroom, and I stood up, and I looked at the judge, the PO, and my lawyer, and I said to all of them, I said, you know what? I said, you can't help me, and you can't help me. I said, I'm putting this in the hands of God. He is the only one that can help me.
Mm-hmm.
Then I sat
Amen.
Down. Then I sat down. So I went to court that day with a girlfriend of mine. She said, girl, are you crazy? I said, nope. I said, I don't know. Something just told me to get up and say that. So right mm-hmm. after that, the courtroom was so quiet, you could hear rat piss on cotton. So
wow.
then the judge said, my lawyer, he was looking at me crazy. P.O. was looking at me crazier because he wanted me to go back to jail. So the judge said, Miss Johnson, he said, I understand you gave up a urine. And he said, is that urine going to come back clean? And you know what? I told him, I said, it's definitely going to come back. Because before I had went to court, it was in August when I had gotten busted by my PO. So I stopped doing the drugs because he said, you're going to go back to jail. And mm-hmm. jail is I wouldn't even put a dog of mine in jail. So anyway, I had stopped and I had really, you know, started you know, stop hanging with the people and, you know, going to them places and all this kind of stuff because I said, I don't want to do this anymore. And I wanted to keep my job because I had a very good job. So he said, is this urine going to be clean? I said, yes, Your Honor, it is. So he said, I tell you what. He said, I'm going to let you go this time. He said, but if you ever come before me again. He said, not only are you going to get your backup time, he said, but I'm going to give you a little something extra.
Wow.
So when I walked out of that courtroom that day, and it's been almost, it's been a little over 30 years, I think, that I have been free, clean of drugs and tobacco.
Praise God.
And
well,
I can, yeah. So
Ms.
that's,
Johnson,
you know, that's the story of that.
Well, we got a lot we want to get into before our time runs out. But I'm also myself a writer, ghostwriter, radio host, as you can see. I have my own perfume line. But I'm going to start to talk about the next phase of her life. And before I introduce that part of her life as a writer, I want to share something that came out of my second book called Wow, and this is called Looking for Daylight. High again and being unreasonable. You're mad because you're broke and there's no one to loan you money. Craving the drug that makes you paranoid, talkative, and in some cases unable to talk at all because of dry mouth and a tongue that has been numbed. Your clothes are wrinkled, makeup smeared or overdone, teeth yellowed, and your breath stinks, and your fingernails are dirty. But this doesn't matter as long as you have the money or drugs with which to get high. You are rushing to the drug man to get a fix. Once you've bargained for the fattest bag of crack, concealing it as if it were gold, you peek around to see if any police are near, and then you scurry off to the place where you can get high. In your mind, you make a mental checklist of all the supplies which will be needed as you visualize what is handy. Yes, I have my smoking pipe, copper, choy, lighters, cigarette, alcohol, mirror, razor blades, baking soda, and spoon. Excited to know the fun is about to begin, you can't wait to get high. As you feel the tingling of anticipation of your first hit, you put your mirror down first so you can catch the drugs before spilling it onto the floor. You open the valuable containers holding the drugs while you look around to make sure all doors are locked and no one can see who was invited to the feast of madness. A hush comes over the room as a smoke billows in the air from your first intake and release of the crack cocaine, exhaled from the overflow of your lungs. Your head begins to spin as sweat flows from your brow. Your heart races and you think, wow, well, that was a good hit. Then you cough because the excess of smoke in your lungs didn't go down the right pipe. Initially, you think of the calmness your body now feels, only to later have it replaced with paranoia at every sound that you begin to hear. As sirens blare in the distance, you rush to peek out of the windows, hoping it's not the SWAT team waiting outside to kick the doors in and bust you on a drug charge. Now that's your drugs are finally gone and your pockets are empty, you begin to aimlessly look around on the floor. You hope to find even the smallest piece of crack to smoke, picking up lint and trash as you taste it and spit it out, realizing your last hit is over. You feel stupid and disgusted over how you've wasted your money. Over and over again, you seek out anything resembling a piece of drug. Flustered, your pockets are empty and you're left with a nasty taste in your mouth. In the sobering moment, you realize this madness and constant nightmare can't continue. Thinking about how you will have to dodge the police while chasing down the drugs, you become ashamed of resorting to lying, stealing, or begging and acting like a fiend for drugs in your brief moment of lucidity. You shake your head and wonder, when will I see daylight? And that came from my second book, Wow, which you can find on my personal website at www.terrylyle.com, T-E-R-R-Y-L-Y-L-E. Now, I used to be a correctional officer. I've been exposed to people who were drug users and drug dealers, you know, because of the crowd that I was with. But I want to ask you, what I just read to you, was any of that any truth that you may speak about?
Yes, it is. Because you know, like I said, it's a drug that that you crave. And once it's gone, you constantly, if you see rocks or whatever that resemble a crack cocaine rock, of course you're going to pick it up and try to smoke it. I can recall an incident when me and this guy was getting high one time, and he was way down at, I'm on one end of the counter. He's on the other end of the counter. And So when I finished, you know, everything was gone. So he's feeling all on it. I said, there's nothing there. You know, that's why I said I preferred getting high by myself, because it's called geeking. When a person gets the geeking for them drugs, it can really blow your high. And, you know, you just don't want to be around those people anymore. So, you know, like, I really prefer that my own company, you know, when I got high.
Okay. Well, my co-host, Yolanda, she has a question. She's been so patient sitting there while I run my mouth. So I'm going to let her ask her question. And then we're going to get into the phase where you went from drugs and how you became a publisher, a writer. We're going to touch on that as well. So, Yolanda, go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. So as you, the tragedy started basically when you were raped, and then you had to go and go back over that whole incident again in court, and then as you got older, you went into drugs and everything and went through the penal system and all of that. At what point did you forgive? Because that's a big part of recovery. At what point in your life did you forgive?
Did I forgive the guy who raped me?
Forgive, period. Forgive him, forgive yourself, for you putting yourself through the things you did.
Right. Okay. Well, I forgave myself 30 years ago, 30 plus some years ago is when I forgave myself, because, you know, it was all destruction to myself and abuse to myself. So once I got clean and my head was clear and I could see things clearly and things were, like, happening so much better for me in my life was when I forgave myself, you know, and I began to love myself and to be more considerate with myself, you know, and do things for myself. So it's been over 30-some years since I forgave myself. Now, with this person who raped me, I just really forgave him, I think, within the last, I would say it hasn't been 5 years, I think. I just, you know, decided to forgive him. And simply because me holding on to that venom like that was not good, because I just would, you know, when I would see him, because like I said, in occasions I would see him, because I seen him after the reunion. I saw him at, you know, at funerals. And, you know, and every time I would see him, you know, I just would, have a flashback. Yeah, so I just said to myself, I just got to let this go. So I, you know, I forgave him, but I will never, ever forget what he did to me.
Never.
And the thought, I still want to know why me. But, you know, I will never know that, because I would never have anything to say to him. And I'm also going to write a memoir about that. Because I didn't get into the part where him and the young lady who testified against him for me, they got into a relationship. They were in a relationship for 17 years. She just died this past January. And when they got into the relationship, I asked her, I said, do you trust him? She said, well, he said that, you know, he was young and he made a mistake and he apologized. Who did he apologize to? Because I hadn't seen him until that day, from the time he had raped me and seeing him in court, you know, until that day, almost 40-something, when I was in my 40s. So I said, well, you know what? I said, if you're happy, I'm happy for you. I said, but never forget, a leprous spot never change. Lo and behold, a few months later, she was calling me, you know, her voice. I knew something was wrong. So I said, well, you know, she said she didn't go to work that particular day. And I said, what, you sick? So she said, no, so-and-so, he beat me up because I wouldn't give him my tax check. I said,
he
what?
He beat her up?
Yes. When they hooked up, he was living in a shelter. She took him out of that shelter, sent him to Pennsylvania, get a CDL license, opened checking accounts and all sort kind of stuff with him. You know, like she had gotten a prize, and you forgot this man was a rapist. And I'm quite sure now that I look back on it, he's breaking chairs on his sister's back, beating his baby's mama. He probably was a serial raper. He's done that before. But anyway, getting back to her, then she calls me and tell me that he's raping her, sodomizing her.
Oh, my goodness. But she
and
stayed
I
with
said,
him 17 years. Why?
Well, let me say this. She, her self-esteem was so low. So she could actually sit on a dime and still swing her legs. That's how low her self-esteem was.
Wow.
And you know, it was really sad because at one point she had tried to get away from him because when I had moved from, I was living in a house in Southeast and I moved into a condo. Well, we had sort of like hooked back up after all the years because we hadn't seen each other. And she told me he was in jail for doing something to her or whatever. But she said that she wanted to move from the apartment before he came back there. So when I went over to look at the condo that I was getting ready to move in, it was a three-bedroom condo, plus it had a loft in it. She said, well, can I rent one of these rooms? I said, no. No, you cannot. So she got an attitude because I told her no. But I said, you know what? I said, number one, I'm not going to trust you like that because if I ever came home and caught him in my place, I said
right.
both of y'all would be dead. I said, I'm
dead.
Sorry. No, no,
dead.
I ain't going to be with him no more. I'm, no, 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 no.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, you know what? You can talk that talk. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not going for that. So, anyway, to make a long
mm-hmm.
story short, she had a sister who was a mortician. And me and her
mm-hmm.
sister, we got along very well. We went to the Bahamas together. You know, we did things together. But because her and my brother was in a relationship years ago. But, anyway, so her sister was a mortician, and she was always talking about, well, she don't want to do this for me, she don't want to help me, this and that. And I couldn't understand why her sister wouldn't help her, but I'm going to make this story as short as possible, and I found out why. What had happened was she had gotten sick, she had a stroke, so her sister moved her to Baltimore. Her sister was living in Baltimore, got her apartment, this and that, and her sister was checking on her. So I would call up there periodically and talk with her, and I talked with her sister. I said, well, how are things going? And when I called up there a little later on, so she said, I don't speak to her anymore. I said, well, what happened? She said, because she went over to her house, and she was acting funny. She wouldn't open the door. So she said she could hear voices in the background. She asked her who was in there. She told her that the guy who raped me was back with her. Now, when he was in jail, he didn't know that she moved to Baltimore. So that tells me that she had to look for him. She had to let him know where she was at. She took this man back over her son, her sister. She wouldn't listen to nobody. They would get into arguments and fights. She'd go stay with her sister, whatever, whatever. But he was a scumbag, and he still is a scumbag. And another one of my girlfriends who is friends with him, so to speak, we were talking, and she told me that he told her he never raped me.
Okay.
I said, you know what? Not only is he a rapist, but he's crazy. I said,
you know,
he is actually out of his mind. So I'm going to write a book about it, the memoirs of it, you know, and, you know, let women know that, you know, when you're raped, don't let it defy your self-worth. You know, keep your head up and keep it moving and forgive. And if you have to keep remembering, there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, a lot of women who have been where I have been are still stuck there because
mm-hmm.
their self-esteem has been so low. They had no one to help them, you know, get out of that situation, or they didn't know how to get out of that situation. How I got out of that situation is I wrote a book called You Might Get Lucky.
Okay, Ms.
Writing
Johnson.
That book. Yeah, yes, ma'am.
Okay. I need you to take a break, breathe a little bit so we can get in and get some of these questions that we want, you know, from the chat room. And the question I wanted to ask you was after that situation with the guy and everything, how soon after that did you change your life around and became a writer?
What, after the guy who raped me?
After the guy raped you and the drug thing, what, you know, was your catalyst for you deciding to write?
Well, I've started writing when I was 8 years old. I've been writing since then. But when I got serious about it was in 2005 when I was forced to retire from my job. I started writing my very first book, which was What's Past Is Not Forgotten. And that book is a simulation of the things that had happened back in the 60s coming up in the projects that I used to live in, the Knox Hill Projects. And some of the events actually happened, but the names have all been changed to protect the innocents. There are some people in the book that I did tell that they were in the book, but it's a fictional story, but, you know, like I said, some of the events are actually happened. As I put events in my book that are real, you know, because I try to make my books as authentic as they can be, but I have been writing forever. Yeah, and
I just want to say this. You're going to give us a chance to ask you these questions, because we got a lot of questions. We got a little bit of time. Now, I've heard you on another show, and you was reading some poetry, and you read this poem called Arizona. By any chance, would you have that handy?
Arizona?
Uh-huh.
I think I do have it handy. Let me see here.
And then after you read that poem, before you get into another story, Shalonda got a question she want to ask you, and then I want to touch on some of the books that you have written before our time expires in 45 minutes.
Let me see. Where's Arizona?
So, just for a recap.
Wait a minute. I got it right. Let me pull out my book right here.
Well, while you're pulling it up, I just want to let my listeners know that if you want to call in and talk to Gail Delicious Johnson, the number is 347-945-6003. She's a writer, she's a publisher, she's an actress, she's a radio host, and she wants to specify to other people that she is a ghostwriter, which means that if you want her to write your story for you, take out the books, and she will make it happen. She'll do what she has to do.
Okay.
But anyway,
it's not called Arizona. It's called Whore.
Oh, it's called Whore. Okay.
Yes. So did you want me to read that or?
Yes, ma'am. I want to give people a little bit of your style of writing. I want you to read that poetry, and then I'm going to also come back and have you read a little bit out of one of your books so I can kind of get an idea of how your writing flows in case they want to, you know, get you to write something for them.
Okay. This is a poem I wrote for, you know, women who are insecure. It's a little short, informal, like a little story for women who are insecure in their relationships. And like I mentioned, the title of it is Whore. Okay? All right. My name is Arizona. I will admit that I'm also known as a whore. I'm not one bit ashamed of my title. At least I'm honest about what I do. Yes, I'm the one you inadvertently sent your husband to, and your boyfriend, significant other, fiancé, and girlfriend. Yes, I said girlfriend. It's not always about the sex. They come to me when you fake a headache, hang out with your girls up in the club, when you bitch and complain for no reason at all. You accuse your man of cheating when he wasn't. You pull that, I don't do that shit with him. That's where I come in. I do it all, and I do it good. Yes, he tells me how much he loves you. Your dumb ass doesn't see it until it's too late. I can't tell you the many times he's called out your name while fucking me. He also tells me how delicious I taste compared to you. Yes, he sets the alarm when he comes to see me, just to get home before you so there won't be an argument. Everything you do, I don't do. I never have a headache, bitch, or complain. Whatever he wants, I give it to him. I smile, but laugh inside, knowing I'm training him for your ungrateful, ignorant ass. You have him every holiday, but guess what? I see him the day before, and I get my gifts as well. As a matter of fact, I picked out the gifts he gave you. Remember the night he came home at 3 o'clock in the morning, saying he was at the hospital with a sick friend? So far from the truth, and you ate it up. I told him to tell you that lie. It's one lie that works the best. The time you found my phone number in his pocket and called me, bitch, please. Did you think I was intimidated by your screaming and hollering? All you did was add another nail in the coffin of your dead relationship. When you confronted him, he left. I don't have to tell you where he came. Yes, he came to me, on me, and in me.
Mm.
I've even been to your house when you called yourself punishing him by going home to mommy. Yes, Miss Thang, we fucked in your bed that whole week. I was there when you called asking him was he ready for you to come home. I told him to tell you yes. Woman, you need to wake up. When you deprive a man of sex, trust and believe. He comes to me to have his desires met. I give him everything you don't and then some. If you want lessons, you better not ask him anything about his teacher. How many times have you kissed my cum off his lips? Mm. Countless times. You are so sure of yourself. You believe it was your flavor? Not so, sweetie. It was mine. Your husband loves you so much, he won't even let you suck his dick. Mm. I know you're sucking somebody else's dick. That's how you undercover freaks are. So he comes to me, and I give him the best blowjobs. He tells me he wishes I was you. I have to remind him, no, he really don't want me to be you. If I was, he would not enjoy the sweet taste of my succulent punani, nor would he experience the ecstasy of uninhibited sex if I was you. You complain about the dumbest things, telling him he don't love you no more because you had a baby. Fool, that's why he gave you a baby. He loved you. You don't take me out anymore. You knew his job downsized and he took a cut in pay just to keep his job to provide for you and his babies. You're an ungrateful asshole. He got so fed up with you and your complaining. Yes, you drove him right into my arms. All he did at first was talk about how much he loved you and wanted the relationship to continue. How you deprived him, how you verbally and mentally badgered him from sunup to sundown. He tells me you sniff his dick and check his drawers for cum stains. You're pitiful. The same soap he has at home, I got it here for him. Mm-hmm. You can sniff the skin off his spear, but you won't smell my fragrance. You need to give him credit. He's not stupid. He's just fed up with you and your bullshit. Instead of you always accusing him of cheating, ask him why he keeps coming back to you, you moron. I'll tell you why. Because he loves you and your low self-esteem issues, all your insecurities and everything about you he loves. You are so stuck on stupid, you can't see the forest for the trees. Mm. Oh, I almost forgot this one. Remember you followed him to that restaurant? Yeah. That was the day you made a complete fool out of yourself. He introduced me to you as his boss and said it was a business luncheon. Yes, it was a luncheon afterwards. I was the dessert. You see, he never went back to work that day. I'm not his boss. I'm your boss. I control your relationship with your permission. After all, you sent him to me. I'm not in love with your man. I love what I do for your man. It gives me such pleasure when he tells me he wants a wife like me, someone who listens to him, understands him, doesn't nag him, and gives him love without restrictions. My name is Arizona. I'm always warm. What gets me hot? Ask your man. And that's whore, I'm sorry.
Wow. And that was like powerful poem you just wrote.
You know, someone asked me recently, what do I do when I have downtime? Thought about this for a moment, and in my mind I thought about a nice, hot, soothing bubble bath, candles, a nice glass of wine, with the right book to read. And instantly I thought about authorist Terry E. Lyle, because I knew I was guaranteed to get a good laugh or some soul-searching, just like a few of her other books, Insane, Peeling Back the Mask, and her latest, Exposed. This author has written 9 books, and I can't pick a favorite. But my advice to you is to make your own choice by going to her personal website, where she even signs the books for free, at www.terrylyle.com, or go to Author House, Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, or your local retailer to get a copy and start your own collection today. This is the last time I'm going to say, you can't borrow mine.
Ooh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Ooh, yeah, yeah.
Well, welcome back to Unmasked with authoress Terry E. Lau and Shalonda, and our special guest tonight, Gail Delicious Johnson. That testimony and commercial was by K.J. Moore in Nebraska. Thank you for supporting me and getting my book. And the song just played was Keisha Cole, I Remember. And we all got something to remember, whether it's good or whether it's bad. We all got some memories, and we got to do what we do to get to the next step. But we just touched on the fact that Mrs. Johnson, she was raped and how she went into promiscuity and drugs and how she brought herself out of that without going through withdrawals. She also decided to write some things that happened in her life, and we just heard one of her poems called Whore, and the person in the poem was called Arizona. And if you think about it, a lot of us women can relate to that because, you know, Quasis Cap, you know, when somebody's paying you for doing what you do, some people can say you're a prostitute, whatever, whatever. But, you know, the only reason why a whore is not defined for women in relationships is because there's love and respect, and whores usually don't have any respect given to them. But without further ado, we want to get back because my co-host got a question, and we want to touch on the different books that Gail wrote and briefly talk about her acting career and what she had done in that arena. And we got a half hour to make it happen. So, Ms. Johnson, when we ask you a question, can we keep it moving? Because you got such a
sure
interesting story that we can't get it all out. So, Shalonda, go ahead.
I'm just long-winded, okay? I'll keep it moving, though. Mm-hmm.
Okay, baby. Shalonda?
Hello, hello?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
It's you, darling.
I still had my mute on from when I was drinking some juice. But, Ms. Gell, I know you grew up in a different time than maybe I have. But did anybody denounce this guy? I see how there's a whole lot of people that still were friends with him after the fact. Like, we had a guy that we grew up with that raped a little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, nobody befriends this guy. I mean, he gets put, he can't even like come in the old neighborhood because people just go all the way left field with him because of the things that he did from when we were children. And he was a teenager, and the girl was probably, he was probably like 17, and the girl was probably like 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And ever since that time, we don't patronize his business. We don't associate with him. He can't come to none of the reunions or anything. Anything, you know, around anybody that he knew when he was younger. Is he's like banished, basically. Mm-hmm. And nobody, none of your friends and nobody felt that way where he couldn't come around us.
Ostracized, yeah.
Well, let me say this. There, you know, the situation with that 17-year-old raping that 11-year-old, of course, there's going to be, the repercussions are going to be a little different, you know, not saying that, you know, she wasn't raped or whatever, but I was 15 and he was 17. So, and then the friends that he had, I didn't know anybody, any of the friends that he had, because like I said, that was the first time I had ever seen him. And the guys who was with him, if they were so willing to tell on him, that tells that they weren't that much of a friend to him as well. And over the years, I didn't see him, so I don't know what his friendships were like or who he dealt with or anything else, you know, of that sort. But, you know, after, and then the fact of the matter, he uprooted and went to Baltimore, also gives me the indication that he basically had nothing going for himself, you know, as far as friends, because he came from a shelter, you know, and then another girlfriend had told me at one point that he had even been in a mental institution. So, you know, I don't know what he was in a mental institution for or anything like that, and I really didn't care. But, you know, just thinking those thoughts give me the indication that he really didn't have that much going on in his life as far as friends were concerned or anything else, because he, you know, even like I said, I was like 47, and he was 3 years older than me. You know, you living in a shelter. How come you're not established and have a home and, you know, your own transportation and, you know, different things like that? And then he gets in a relationship, and he's raping the girl he's in a relationship with. So he's not even he hasn't even been rehabilitated as far as I'm concerned. You know, so that, you know, the situation with that 11-year-old, you know, I think that was because simply the fact that as a child, you know, a baby almost, and a 17-year-old doing that to a baby, of course, he should have been tarred and feathered for that, you know, as well as any rapist. You know, I think rapists are right up there with murderers and, you know, the other scumbags like that, because when you rape somebody, that's the lowest form of degrading a woman, man, child, or whatever that you can do to them, you know, to put that fear in them. Just to have that satisfaction of you knowing that you put that fear in them, because it's not about sex. It's not about the sex. It's not about the gratification of having an orgasm and, you know, things like that. It's just about putting that fear into that person, having that control over that person, you know, and that I can't even, when I see that scene, when I see that night, it just makes me, I can't even describe how I feel. It takes my breath away when he just was, from when he abducted me to the point of him dropping me off. And then he had the audacity to ask me, was I going to tell somebody? You know, so he knew what he did was wrong. And, you know, then he continued, you know, raping the girl that testified against him, being in a relationship with her. You know, he's not a good person. Even to this day, like I had mentioned, he said he never raped me, but the book will tell everything. You know, I'm going to do a memoir about me being raped, so look for that probably in 2015. Yes, ma'am.
Let me find out about your writing and your acting, because I saw a short clip of you acting, and you did a very good job, so... Were you starting to act at the same time you became a writer?
Well, when I was in elementary school, I'd been in a few plays, and a guy at one point that came in, I think I was maybe about 9 or 10 years old, a guy did a film, and lo and behold, the night when he showed that I didn't get to see it because I was on punishment, but he had gotten some kids from the neighborhood, and I was one of them that was in the film. And I didn't get to see it, but I was in a few plays growing up. And how I got to do that particular movie, that short film by Mitch Creedle, he's a local producer, writer, author, and he, you know, does quite a few things for the community. And he had sent me the manuscript to read for this particular web series, web film, short movie that was called Where Have You Been? And it's a story about these two boys who are raised by their grandmother, which I played the grandmother, Grandma Rose, and I had 5 sons. And their father had abandoned them, but the thing that he had caused so much pain in the family was that it was two sisters, because the boys were actually brothers and cousins at the same time, because he had raped one of the sisters and had a baby by her and was married to her. And it was just, you know, the story was really heartfelt. And I really felt something, you know, doing that story, because you could see the emotion in each of those characters' eyes, how they carried that. You know, and Mitch, he does a phenomenal job writing scripts, and I was really humbled and, you know, really grateful that he gave me that part to play, you know, as the two young men's grandmother. And my sons, all my sons were handsome guys. Yeah, that was, and the first time I did, I worked with Mitch was when he was doing a series called Diva Wars, and I was in episode 6 of that, episode 6 or episode 5, as an extra. And, you know, it just, you know, it gives me great pleasure to work with people who are, you know, talented as they are, because also Mitch and another writer here, Anthony Commodore, they work together. They are two phenomenal forces. You know, they've been doing a lot of projects together, and, you know, they're working on something now called Boss, so, you know, be looking out for that. But, yeah, that's how my acting started, way, way back, doing stage.
Yeah. Well, I am familiar with Anthony Commodore's work. He's one of my friends on Facebook, and he has sent me some of his trailers, and his work is phenomenal, to say the least.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I just want to touch on real quick. You Might Get Lucky was your first book, and was that the catalyst from your life after being raped, or is it something that fictitious popped in your head?
You broke up for a minute. What did you say, darling?
I was saying that Anthony Commodore, I was seeing some of his trailers. He's a Facebook friend of mine, and his work is phenomenal. And I was asking you about your book, You Might Get Lucky. That was your first book. Was that based on your life after being raped, because, you know, you had a different attitude then, you know, because that distrust of men because of what happened to you would probably generate that You Might Get Lucky kind of attitude? And how many other books have you written? And tell us about those.
Well, actually, you was breaking up again, but actually I think the very first book that I wrote, which was The Reunion, was basically taking bits and pieces from what had happened as far as my rape was concerned, but it's in fictional form. And, you know, you're reading it, no one would know that, you know, what it, they couldn't say that was me. See what I'm saying? Because I have it so that I'm this other girl that's in the book, and this one who was raped is another girl. But it's just... that's when I had started. But me writing You Might Get Lucky was very therapeutic for me, because it also had me to express. In this book, You Might Get Lucky is about a young man who is violated in his youth and how he suppressed it and got on with his life. But something had caused him to go and have flashbacks. And then he wanted to get revenge with his brother who had violated him in his youth. And one thing led to another. And I was feeling the same way, because thoughts was going through my head. I wish I could do this to him. I wish that would happen, blah, blah, blah. You know, just wanting revenge on this guy who had did to me. So writing this book, You Might Get Lucky, was very, very therapeutic for me. And I've gotten such great reviews on the book until, you know, I am glad that I did write it, because a lot of people can relate to Lucky's story. Because, you know, men are raped as well. But it's never, you never hear on the news, rarely do you hear on the news where a man was raped and he reported it. Even though some men are raped every 6 minutes. But you're not going to hear about it, because men, they have their ego, they have this, that even gay men don't want to report it. But,
I guess,
you know, rape is rape.
I guess they're stronger than women are, and for a man,
right, and then
to
it
be
takes
dominated
away their
by
masculinity
woman.
If you're telling someone that a man raped you. So you rarely hear about men reporting their rape, but this story is for, if any man would read it who has been raped, you know, to tell on the rapist, because if you don't tell, they will continue it, and if, you know, it may turn into killing or whatever, but, you know. And this book, like I said, was very therapeutic for me to write. You Might Get Lucky. And I got one guy who read it. He said this book deserves to be on the New York number one Times bestsellers list, which all my books should be. But
I ain't mad at you for saying
but,
that.
But, you know, I just got so much praise from You Might Get Lucky, yes. And you can order that book from my website. One of what? Books?
Yes.
Well, I've written 5 books. You Might Get Lucky was my second book, and my third book was a book of delicious erotic short stories. Then I wrote the sequel to You Might Get the Reunion, which was called What's Past Is Not Forgotten. The Reunion, the first one was What's Past Is Not Forgotten, and The Reunion sort of summed up everything that happened in the. The first one, What's Past Is Not Forgotten, because some things really changed in the sequel. Then my final book I wrote once I started my publishing company, JJ Publisher, and that's my fifth book, and it's published under my company as Back to Zero. And that is a story about law enforcement officials who are married to each other. And one of the husband, he's so abusive. He is just horrible. It's basically a love story involving abuse. Involving abuse, lust, lies, secrets. You know, it's just it has all the elements of a good book, which it is. It's a wonderful book. And
but you know
can also
something,
get that.
I've noticed that, you know, when I used to be into law enforcement myself back in my earlier years working, I've learned that a lot of people in law enforcement, you know, they believe that they can just get away with anything they want to do because, you know, their buddies, the people that normal people will call for help, they are their coworkers, you know. So, and a lot of times, you know, they have these abusive relationships because they got that sense of you can't do shit to me because, who are you going to call? You calling my friends, and they're not going to, you know, do anything. So
right.
I understand that. That happens more often than people realize. People into law enforcement, sometimes they get so full of their damn self, they think they're John Wayne, they can just do anything, you know?
Right. Now, not to say that, because there are some law enforcement officials that are just wonderful, you know, and I know a few of them that are just wonderful and, you know, are honest as far as when it comes to protecting and serving the public, you know, but you have these other ones that actually think they are above the law. They can do what they want to do, and they do what they want to do, you know, and they get away with it because they have the force backing them up. You know, everything they do is justified. If you kill somebody, it's justified. You beat somebody, it's justified, you know, but God has the final say. So if you think
yes,
you got
does.
Away with it, you know, keep on thinking it, but, you know, you still have one more judge, and that's the judge to face.
Well, Shalonda has a question, Gail, that she want to ask.
All right, darling.
Okay. I know that you're writing two books. I know you spoke of the one about your life. What's the other book that you're writing or trying to get put together now?
Okay, well, the memoirs probably won't be out until 2015, but I'm working on a book called The Scent of a Man. I'm working on that, and I'm going to do another book of short erotic stories. I have an excerpt. I would like to read that if I get a chance to one of the stories that's going to go in the book. But I'm just, and, you know, like I'm also a publisher, so I have some manuscripts that I will be working on eventually, but, you know, that's going to come at a different time. But, yeah, those.
If you want to read one of your little short stories, you can do it right now.
No, this is just an excerpt from one of the short stories I'm going to go. Okay, this one is called Married Man, Single Dick. Okay. Get your clothes on, Lola. It's time for you to go.
Lola?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Start back over.
You know somebody named Lola?
That's
my mom.
Oh, okay. Well, this is not about your mom.
I know
okay.
That's
right. All right. Okay. Get your clothes on, Lola. It's time for you to go. Lola turns over in the bed, exposing her voluptuous chocolate breasts. She is not ready to leave. She wants more of Raymond's dick. She looks up at Raymond as he stands naked in front of her with half an erection. Lola laughs and points at his semi-hard penis and says, What about that? What about it? He sarcastically answered. Lola moves swiftly to the edge of the bed. She grabs his tool, kisses it, and gently massages it as she coos. Now you know you really don't want me to leave. Raymond's pipe is hot and expanding in her hand. He closes his eyes and moans out. Oh, shit, Lola. Feels good? Lola asked just above a whisper. You know what you're doing, he said breathlessly. Suddenly, he felt the warmth and wetness of Lola's mouth on his dick. He felt the suction and hard slurping of her tongue as she licked, sucked, and deep-throated his manhood. The fingers on her other hand are busy toying with her own heat. She is moving them in and out of her hot box with every suck of Raymond's rod. She is moaning as she pleasures his magic wand and herself. Lola felt her volcano heat up. She felt the pulsation in her juices flowing like a river. She stops fingering herself because she was close to a climax. She wanted to come on his dick. She withdraws his penis from her mouth and says, "Let's fuck now." Raymond immediately obliges her. He lies on her and guides his missile into her waiting, wet, and warm cunt. His strokes were long and purposeful. He was fucking her like she was his wife. He says in a very sexy voice to Lola, "You want me to come?" "Yes, I want you to come. Beg me." This made Lola's pussy gush. She was so turned on by his demand. Raymond could feel her sex pulsate. "Beg me," he repeated. "Make me come." Lola could feel his deliberate withdrawal from her kitty. He knew by her moan he had hit the spot. She felt her clit quivering as he rubbed his anaconda back and forth over the spot. Her attention was focused solely on the wonderful sensation that was about to burst through her body and the realization that the growling she heard was being made by her sent her into a wave of climax. And that's going to be either, I don't know if it's going to be a full story or a short story that I'm going to put in my next book that I do on erotic stories. Yes, yes,
your
ma'am.
Your imagination is something, you know. I mean, you're very well versed in the erotica as well as the regular work, you know, so you don't have no specialty that you prefer in your writing.
Well, when I write, it just comes out the way that I'm feeling, you know, because if I feel a certain way, that's how I'm going to write. If I'm thinking a certain way, or, you know, how I put the two of them together, my feelings and my thoughts, and, you know, let them battle it out, and then it comes on down on the paper.
Wow. Shalonda, darling, do you have a question for our guests? Because I'm going to take a small break after your question. We're going to come back and find out how to get a hold of Mrs. Johnson and get her books, and she can give you some information about her publishing company. Go ahead, Shalonda.
How many, you had said you were a ghostwriter, and I was really interested in that. I had never met a ghostwriter before in person, but I've heard of them. How many books? I mean, yeah, no, I just found out you're one this time. You actually stepped out with you that either. So it's great I know two ghostwriters. But how many books could you say that you wrote for that actually were hits? Even I know you can't take credit for them because of the payment for the ghostwriting, but you know how sometimes you might drive and you look at the bestseller list or something, you say, "That's our book right there."
So approximately
how many books have you ghostwritten for?
I've ghostwritten one book, and that was the last book that I wrote, Back to Zero. That book was ghostwritten for a very it was written for a young man who really didn't appreciate the craft, so I put the book out myself.
Okay.
Yes.
Ghostwritten.
You got the book out too?
Yeah. Pardon?
So you saying it's two books out there?
No, I didn't say it was two books out there. I said I ghost wrote Back to Zero.
Okay.
Now, if there are two books out there, pardon?
I said I've heard that title before.
It's on her book list. But happened was it was originally ghost written, but since it didn't publish under him,
published it yourself? No. I ghost wrote the book for a person.
Mm-hmm.
And the person did not pay me for the book.
Right.
Okay. So some other things that went down in between that, but simply because for non-payment, you don't get something for free. Right. You're living in your house, you don't pay the mortgage, they're going to confiscate that house. You don't pay your car note, they're going to confiscate your car. I don't care if you paid it up and you got one more payment, and you don't make that last payment, they're going to confiscate that car.
So you're saying you had a contractual agreement?
No, no. We did not have the contract was never signed. This person was a difficult, let's just say this. This person was a very difficult client. And it all boiled down to him wanting to run my company the way he wanted to run it. And I established this company and run it the way I want to run it. So when he did not pay me, finish paying me for the book, I took the book back and I published it. He didn't write a sentence of the book.
Right.
And see, when you ghostwrite for some, and I've learned a few things over, you know, since this incident happened, and this is something that will never, ever happen to me again in life. Never. Because if you come into my company and think you're going to run it, you're going to run right out of it. Because I run my company the way that I want to run it. And if you can't abide by the rules that I have in my company, then this is not the company that you want to be in. Because I have rules and I have regulations, and if you can't abide by them and you can't be respectful of me like I respect you, then you need to go and start your own publishing company, or you need to find another publishing company. Simple as that. So that is how. Now, true, there may be another book out there, Back to Zero, and, you know, if this person had put it out there, it's the same one that I wrote, but I do understand that there, because when the manuscript was sent back to me after I had sent it to this person, they had taken some things out of it that, you know, but in my book, I put the things back in it. You know, I don't know what their book is about now or anything like that, but trust and believe, Back to Zero by Gail Delicious Johnson is the one that you want to purchase.
Wow.
Understood.
That must be, excuse me, that must be difficult on you and the other person. And
no, it's not difficult on me because I know that I wrote the book. You see what I'm saying? The other person, they may be running around saying that they wrote it, they did this, they did that, but you know what?
Well, let me ask you a question about that. Okay, you physically wrote the book, but if it's the other person's story, why
is it
their
book? Story. It's not because, number one, let me say this. Just like when a songwriter writes a song and you sing the songwriter gets the credit for that. That's how that goes. Now, you can sing the song till your heart fall out, but when you, the songwriter gets the credit for that song.
Wow. Well,
so,
I had
you know,
a similar thing myself. I was a ghostwriter for someone, and my big issue was that the person refused to sign a contract. And I believe that the person was reputable because they was a minister. However, you know, the person kept saying, no, I'm going to take care of you. We don't need to do this. And based on our religious connection, I believe that lie. Excuse
yeah,
me.
You trusted
but anyway, they didn't want to pay me. So what I did was I just put my name on the book because I wrote the book. And the reason I say I wrote the book is because this person only gave me documentations of different time periods when they were in the military. And I created the story and the characters to fit those locations that he was at to make it a book. And since he didn't
right.
want to pay for ghostwriting fees, my name went on it. Case closed. And from now on, I don't care who it is. If you don't sign a contract, I cannot work with you because
right.
that taught me a valuable lesson, you know. And we had a big stink for a long time. He kept saying, this is my book. I said, well, did you pick up a piece of crayon, a pencil, or ink pen? Did you write any damn thing? You didn't write shit. Quasar's cap. I wrote it, you know. And just because you gave me a paper that says, I was in the military on this date, what the hell is that? There ain't no story. That's just documentation.
Yep, and the thing about me doing this book, the only thing he gave me information, little tidbits here, but what I did was I created around the information that he gave me because if he, you know what, I did research for this book. This book was a book written from my heart and my soul. Do you hear me? I stayed up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning doing research, doing this, doing that. He would call me and say, ask me what I'm doing. I'm not doing anything. Well, shouldn't you be working on the book? You know, it was almost as if I was a slave or whatever. But I wrote each and every line of this book. And, like, well, I'm not worried or concerned about anything, because he's the one who is lying about everything, telling people that he wrote the book, because he didn't. It's going to be proven that he didn't write the book. So,
well,
you know,
write another one.
I didn't hear you.
Tell him write another one.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, let him write another one. And then I'm telling you, and if people who read my books know the type of love scenes that I write, different mm-hmm. things like that, it's no way in the world that he couldn't even think of the love scenes that I wrote in that book. But, you know, so.
That it was a he, so I'm taking that this was a male that you wrote this book for. Is there any way possible at this stage that y'all can come together, some kind of resolution to either pay you what is owed, or y'all put both names on the book? I mean, is there any resolution in sight other than going to court?
You know what? I really don't think so, because this person is so arrogant, and his ego is bigger than his whole body until it's, you know, he's not the type of person, because, number one, if he was that type of person, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in, because
right.
he would have signed the contract and everything would have been a go. He would have paid me. So he's not even that type of person. So I'm not even going to put myself in that position again for
right.
him to disrespect me like he did. That will never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
How did he disrespect
not as long
you?
As I'm black.
How did he disrespect you?
He cursed me out as
what?
If I had did something to his mother. And you know how people don't
Why?
Play with their mother. He
right.
cursed me out. And for what? Because he felt like it. You know, cause like I said,
well,
his ego is so
enough?
Big. Huh?
You wasn't working fast enough to get the book done?
No. Mm-mm. That wasn't it. I believe somebody had put something in his ear, because what had happened was the editor that I had at that particular time, she confessed afterwards that she really, because it was a white woman, not saying that white people can't edit, but she said that because of the different, you know, because we speak different, you know, which she admitted
yeah.
that she couldn't, you know, the dialect and all this and that. So I had explained that to him, but he just went. And then, being childish, he stopped speaking to me. You know, you're supposed to keep in contact with your publisher. If you have any issues, you are supposed to take it up with your publisher. So I'm believing that maybe somebody got in his ear and was saying this and saying that, blah, 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 blah. So when I had, you know, talked with him about it, when he had sent me the manuscript back after he claimed him and this other person had corrected everything, and I was telling him, I said, well, you know, it was your responsibility. Before I got the whole word responsibility out, this thing lit up. I mean, he just, and then he hung the phone up on me. Now, what kind of person, I mean, you're supposed to be a grown man, and you cannot talk to me in a professional manner and tell me the issues that you're having so we could settle it, you know, and get things moved, because all it was a matter of getting an editor. And trust and believe, the book now has been edited by a gentleman in Canada. Excellent. The book, oh, my God. When I read this book after he edited, I said, oh, if I had only had him in the beginning. But, you know, things happen the way they happen for a reason. Maybe it wasn't even meant for me to write this, because a friend of mine told me if he had only known that I was doing this book for him, he would have told me not to do it.
Wow.
And I would
wow.
have listened to that person, too. But, you know, just it was just too late. But, you know, God works in a way that he wants things to come out. But trust and believe, I'm not a liar. I'm not a thief. And I'm not, my ego is in place. Everybody has an ego, But trust and believe, my ego is in place. I don't try to down people. I don't try to step on people's feet to get to where I'm going, because if we can't hold hands to get there together, I get there by myself. I might pull you up, but I'm not going to step on nobody's toes to get to nowhere, because guess what? The ass is going to be attached to that person's butt that I... The butt that I'm going to kiss coming down is going to be attached to the same person's foot that I stepped on to get to where I was going.
Wow. Well, we need to take a real quick break and come back and get your information. And stay with us. We'll be back in 2 and 2.
Okay.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I want to take you. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama. Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go? Jamaica, off the Florida Keys. There's a place called Kokomo. That's where you want to go to get away from it. Bodies in the sand, tropical drinks melting in your hand. We'll be falling in love to the rhythm of a Cuban band down in Kokomo.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take you to Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama, Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go?
Special guest tonight was Gail Delicious Johnson, sharing her life and her trials and tribulations, from being raped to coming into her own as a actress, writer, radio host, publisher. And I just want everyone to know that I want you to fraternize my website at www.terrylyle.com and check out my 9 books. Check out my perfume line, and I got a brand new fragrance that just came out. I haven't updated my website yet. It's called Hot Stuff. It's a men's fragrance, and it smells yum, delicious, girls. But anyway, I see that Shalonda want to ask Gail something else before we get up out of here, because we're into overtime. So, Shalonda, go ahead, baby, and ask Gail what you want to say before we rock one out of here. Shalonda?
Hello?
Yeah, she keeps putting her phone on mute.
I'm sorry,
here,
y'all.
Darling?
I got kids.
I understand.
just wanted to ask Ms. Gail, what's next on her artistic agenda? She does so many different things with the arts. Do you have any other talents that you're hiding, maybe like drawing, painting, chalking,
well,
anything like that?
No, but I am going to I'm making my own perfume. And I'm going to, it's something else that I'm going to be doing, but I can't really think of it right now. But, you know, writing is my passion. So, mm-hmm. And I'm going to be doing some speaking. I was invited to Germany, but I'm kind of leery about that because them planes keep going down. So I don't know. But
I would go. That's a wonderful invite. Go,
oh,
ahead, girl.
I know. No doubt. No doubt. And I've sent 100 books over there. So that's something that I'm working on. You know, speaking. And, you know, I really want to help women who have been, be a voice for women who have been in the situation that I've been in and, you know, possibly are still victims in that situation, and also to speak to survivors who were in that situation so we can get the word out there. You know, don't be ashamed. Don't feel like it was your fault. And, you know, keep your head up and, you know, forgive and, you know, keep it moving, you know. And that all sounds so easily when I say mm-hmm. it like that. But, you know, sometimes we need therapy, and there are things that you can do that are therapeutic. You know, maybe you could write a book or, you know, take up a craft, a hobby or something, you know. But don't give yourself those little pity parties. And, you know, it's not the end of the world. It could be just the first day of the rest of your life once you just open up and let go and let God.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Amen. So with that note, Ms. Johnson, can you share with us how to get a hold of you if we want to use your services as a publisher or want to read your many books?
Oh, okay. Well, I have a website that's JJ Publishing. That's JAYJAYPublishing.com. I'm also on Facebook, Facebook.com/ Gail Delicious Johnson. I have a fan page on there as well. That's JJ Publishing, JAYJAYPublishing.com. And also, I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter. I'm just everywhere, so you can also Google Gail Delicious Johnson and, you know, go to my website and pick up my books. I have, and I'm also getting ready to bring to to get some copies of my past book, Book of Delicious Erotic Short Stories, because I've had requests for that, but that was under a different publishing company. The only book I have published under my company is Back to Zero, but I am going to get a few of those out, so when I get them out, I'm only going to sell those up, and that'll be it with that particular book. And, you know, with that being said, I do appreciate, you know, you have me on your show tonight, Terry and Shalandra, and hopefully who's mm-hmm. ever listened, they walk away with something, you know, as mm-hmm. far as, like, if you're a victim or if someone is abusing you, you're in a domestic violence relationship or someone's abusing
get
you sexually,
right,
not only you but maybe your child, get help, get out of that relationship, because no one can love you and beat you at the same time, you know, so...
Oh,
I want to, you know, say that. And again, thank you, ladies, for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. No,
thank
no doubt.
You
it was our pleasure.
For being on with us and sharing your experiences.
And
okay.
It's been a pleasure, and I want everybody to remember that, you know, come on back next Friday at 7:30 and hang out with the sisters, because we always got something that you want to hear. We're going to bring interesting stories to you. And always is for you. And with that being said, thank you for tuning in to Unmasked. And now it's almost 10:15. You still got time to get to that party. So get there, but be safe when you're trying to get there.
Right.
Good night, everybody.
Everybody
good
have
night.
A good night. Be safe.
Amen.